runasradio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the weekly internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell and Greg Hughes. This is Carl Franklin, introducing show number 38 with guest Steve Riley, recorded live at TechEd Europe, Thursday, November 15th, 2007. Run As Radio is produced each week by Pwop Productions, offering professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com.
Hi, I'm Richard Campbell. You're listening to Run As Radio. I'm here in Barcelona for TechEd IT Forum with Greg Hughes.
Hi, Richard. How you doing?
Real good. We're all finished with Speaker Idol. One more day of the show to go. And look who we found, but Steve Riley.
Yeah, Steve Riley, security speaker and knowledge expert extraordinaire from Microsoft. How are you, Steve?
Pretty good. A little bit exhausted. This has been a very busy week here in Barcelona. But you know what? I'd rather be busy than idle.
That's true. And you were one of the judges on Speaker Idol.
Speaking of Idol.
It was a lot of fun to do that. But
I had a blast.
It is, it's a lot of work, too. It's hard work to look at all those presentations and make good comments.
And to find something unique to say about each person's presentation, too.
Absolutely.
I think that's kind of important.
I think we got the easiest job being hosts. We just got to be on and charming and moving people along.
That's right, which you guys do a fantastic job of, by the way.
Thanks very much. So, I mean, you're a security guy. What's on your mind these days for security?
Well, there's a lot of things that one could choose to talk about to answer that question. One that's kind of become important to me again lately is users. I see a huge question in the minds of many people, whether they're customers or even security consultants. How much education do the users need? Do we need to educate them? Not at all. And build the technology so that it's virtually foolproof.
And there's always an energy around that of it should be so simple they need to know nothing.
Right. Or do we assume that users can figure out everything on their own? It's popular, although maybe sometimes lacking in specifics, to compare information security to driving a car. We don't build automobiles such that they can be driven by children who have no knowledge. We make certain assumptions that drivers need to have basic skills, and we have a mechanism to teach them those skills. And then in most areas of the world, not only do we teach them, but we have a licensing mechanism that you prove you have the skills. I'm not exactly sure if we need to license computer people or, you know, users.
Right.
But my feeling, at least right now in the manner, is that there's still a certain amount of responsibility on the part of a user to make sure that, just like they are careful about where they drive, that they're careful about where they go on the internet.
Sure. I mean, ultimately, isn't everyone or every user or customer of an IT department, if you will, or of a security department, aren't they really all security employees in some way, shape, or form?
They are, but they haven't been made aware of that yet. Or if they have, they haven't been made aware in a way that they care. A lot of people spend a lot of time thinking about user awareness. How do we make them care? How do we make them more intelligent? And in many cases, just like when I find I'm speaking to an audience, you have to appeal to emotion. Sometimes it can be laughter. Sometimes it can be curiosity. I saw a really interesting awareness campaign one time that involved making people know just about, you know, about just how much money their competitor lost after a break-in. It was something on the order of like $350 million. So they created a bunch of posters, blue background with a big white 3, put these around the facility. Now, if you were walking down the hallway and you saw a poster with a big white 3, what would your reaction be?
No idea. We're number 3?
Where does that come from, right?
That's totally bizarre.
People talk about it. Next week, it's a 350. Where's this going? Next week, it's the full number, 350 million. And the week after that, you finally finish the poster. $350 million loss by the guy next door. How much will you cost us?
Right. Pretty impactful campaign.
Yeah, and it's just something that people remember, right? Because they're like, oh, wow, I don't want to be part of that. I don't want to cost the company anything.
I think a lot of the time we're talking about, you can call them users, you can call them customers, you can call them whatever, the people that we work with,
mm-hmm.
you know, our compadres or whatever. It doesn't really matter, but they're people. And as technologists, there's a tendency to really focus on the gadgets and the technology and the software and all the things that we can put in place to allow people to do things or keep them from doing certain things. And there's a real tendency in many cases not to focus on really addressing the people aspects of that critical component of business.
Right. And in some cases, when we start to address the people aspects, we're not going to get it right the first time. We will learn. We will improve. Finding that magic spot where the people and the technology work well together is real difficult, but it always feels really good when it finally does happen. And I think some of the things that we've been adding to the operating system with Windows Vista, while they might seem challenging, are leading us toward that spot.
Are you talking about UAC?
No, actually, I'm not thinking about UAC. I'm
okay.
thinking about something like high-value certificates.
Okay, yeah.
High-value certificates could actually lead to the retraining of users.
Sure, I see the green bar, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Hey, I admit, I look for the green bar now for PayPal. It's the only one I know of. But PayPal's got such a terrible circumstance where you're on somebody else's site, and then you go to pay, mm-hmm. and it looks like you're sort of, maybe kind of on PayPal, but you're never really sure. And the green bar just solves the problem.
Exactly, exactly. And this is maybe what I'm thinking about. I'm thinking about default configurations that assume that people want to be secure and don't require them to choose to be secure, which we actually started back with Windows Server 2003 and I think are improving there. I want to see us do more things like the high value certificate where we can change user behavior because it helps them understand risk.
Makes it more usable.
Right,
really.
Right. Yeah. UAC is an extremely important feature, but in its current implementation, I'm not sure that people understand risk associated with making the decision to click yes or no.
Well, I think the average user doesn't know the correct answer to that question. And we could go into the debate of if they even care. They care about, you know, one point of view would say that they only care about what makes me allowed to go on to do what I wanted to do. But I think there are conscientious users who look at that and say, I don't know why I would ever say no.
And right. And what's interesting is that Microsoft has two views when it comes to that. The firewall in Windows XP and Windows Vista does not provide outbound kind of program permissions, right? You know, do you want to let IE access the internet? Do you want to let Notepad talk to the internet? And that feature is not there for two reasons. One is it can be very easily spoofed. It can be bypassed if you're running as a local administrator. It's really not a firewall's job to block outbound traffic. But also, we don't have that feature there because people don't know how to answer. They'll always answer in the insecure way. But then here's UAC doing exactly the same kind of thing. I don't want to sound like I'm slamming the technology, but I do believe that in future versions of Windows and maybe even service packs, we're going to get better. So please, don't shut it off.
Well, I agree. You know, it isn't right yet, but the intent is good.
Absolutely.
Now we just got to work on making it right.
Yes.
I think nobody knew what UAC was really going to look like until we put it in the field. Because mm-hmm. you never realized just how many administrator events there are in a given work day.
And how much work we did between the beta and the release to reduce the number of prompts.
Yeah, it was a big, having experienced that, it was a big, big change. I see what you mean, though. If you go back to the car analogy, I mean, the idea that I have to go out and take the chocks out of the wheels every time that I stop the car at a red light. Right, it doesn't work. I mean, it's not the kind of thing that makes driving usable.
Mm-hmm. No. The other thing that's a bit challenging when it comes to securing users is teaching them how to recognize fraud. And this kind of comes back to the example you gave earlier of PayPal, and now you know when the good PayPal.
Yeah, when you got the real PayPal in front of you.
All right. People basically have good BS detectors, right?
It's true.
Especially as we've seen what's happened in politics recently, people have gotten better at that. But it's amazing that for every increment of improvement you can get in your BS detector, somebody else has figured out a way to circumvent that, right? With just the right enticing wording in the email they send you, you'll forget everything you've been trained and dive for that link. All right?
My favorite one right now that I just heard about was the stripper program, where you ran the stripper program in order to see the girl naked. You had to enter in this passcode, which was one of those screen prompts. And actually, that was a screen prompt pulled off of Google Mail, their protection to stop people from automating the creation of Google Mail accounts. And so you just help the hacker get a new mail account.
Right, right. I've seen variants of that that will prompt you for your logon password for your network. All right. And that's actually a very old trick. There was a Unix worm from probably about 12 years ago that would say, hey, we want to test out a new graphics engine. Please run this game. And oh, by the way, you're going to have to log in again. Use your network password, which to many people means their CorpNet password, right?
So, Steve, how do we teach users? I mean, what are your ideas? What do we do to get users, get their arms, their heads, and everything around fraud and safe online experience?
Well, what I have found, at least has worked for some people that I've worked with, is to get them to realize the direction of the communication. If it's something they asked for, it's probably legitimate. If it's something that appeared that they didn't ask for, then they should always assume a stance of distrust. Now, I don't like the way that sounds.
Oh,
but
that's real,
in civil society, that's not a good idea. But, you know, when it comes to living on the internet, I think maybe it is.
But, you know, it's funny because we do that naturally. If somebody approaches you on the street asking you for something, you tend to be distrustful as opposed to you approaching someone saying, can I help you?
Mm-hmm.
That's two different behaviors. So I think it's more that we don't have the right instincts in the internet world or in the technical environment because we just don't perceive that you're asking or being asked.
Right. And that's because the internet grew up as something in the beginning that the 15 people who used it trusted it.
Right.
And then when we get personal computers, they weren't connected to the internet, so we trusted it. And then we bring in the network connection, so there's no reason to change our pre-existing behavior.
And there's a lot of protocols and different original legacy applications, the way TCP/IP was built, the way the email is put together. Go back to Gopher and a bunch of the old stuff that isn't, thank God, isn't used so much anymore.
Right.
But a lot of things that still are around that were built and based in a philosophy of people will use it for good.
That's right. There was no reason not to trust it. You know, we as humans grew up as hunter-gatherers who, by default, didn't trust anybody not in our tribe.
This concept of defensive programming and defensive design
is all
threat
new.
Modeling is all new. It's and those of us, like you and I, that are on this day in and day out and always talking about it understand that, but it really just hasn't always had to be that way, and therefore it hasn't been that way.
No. You know, there's another area that I think is something that we need to maybe spend more time working with customers and partners about, and maybe even users. Perhaps we haven't done as good of a job as we need to, and when I say we, I mean the industry, not Microsoft specifically, helping people remain aware of what the bad guys are doing.
Right. Yeah, just the whole thing that they evolve too. They're learning what we figured out. They stop doing the old scans. I haven't got an email from Anna Kournikova in a long time.
Yeah. Or, you know, when's the last time that you saw a blaster on your machine, right?
Yeah, it's still out there, but
I know, yeah. But, you know, sometimes we're just going to have to live with a few of these things forever.
Right, yeah.
I was glad to see that we issued the second release of the threat report. I know I'm getting the title there wrong. But the MSRC has released two reports.
Yep. Last week.
The second one just came out last week.
Right.
And this is great work. This is not work that, you know, tries to sell Microsoft products or anything. It's all about making admins and IT pros aware of where the bad guys are going and maybe help them predict where the bad guys will go next.
They're providing good information to the people that need it.
Well, and the trend we see is that And I guess this has been true for a while, but it just keeps becoming more and more evident, is that the money in tacking is just phenomenally huge now.
Yeah.
You know, for a while, spammers have had to pay virus writers to create malicious software to use to deliver their spam. You guys have probably heard of the storm worm. Maybe you have. Maybe
I have indeed.
Okay.
And I was thinking exactly that. It's just the sophistication level took a jump forward.
It did. Storm has infected over 1 million machines. And it has not yet been called. It's just sitting there.
Sitting there waiting.
And the industry is having real trouble getting rid of this code. What happens when whoever is running Storm sends the call?
Wake up.
I fear for the financial well-being of, you know, developing as well as developed countries here, just because we've seen these worms cause so much financial damage now. Here we've got a million computers waiting to be pulled into action. Maybe I sound like I'm a little alarmist here. I don't intend to be, but
That's in a way that's your job, right? If the information is alarming information, then that's the information that needs to be imparted.
I see a lot of people who claim to be security professionals trying to prolong their job and motivate people by fear. You know, that doesn't work for governments. It's not going to work for information security either. Most of what you see masquerading as malicious code that you need to worry about is actually just crap that you can ignore. It's the one in 10,000 that's going to cause you problems, right?
The ones that really do matter.
Right. Yep. And it's looking like Storm might become that.
Well, and so far the red codes and the blasters were just propagators. They never had a payload. Their harm was in their ability to spread.
Right, which was, you know, denial of service attacks.
Right, yep. But Storm, what's fascinating about Storm is it's spreading very gently. Mm-hmm. It doesn't do any harm. It's quite polite in its behavior. So it's got to have a payload. We just don't know what it is.
Or it is becoming the remotely installable platform for delivering a payload in the future.
Whatever that may be.
Yeah.
And you know, you just sort of mentioned this, but I think people need to sink in the idea that your regular virus scanner doesn't clean this up.
No. Mm-mm.
I mean, what have they done to make it so robust?
Well, Storm has a lot of different ways to attempt to hide itself. It has some rootkit-style behaviors. It recompiles itself so it looks like something different, so standard signature-based detection isn't going to work in a case like this. And even behavior or anomaly detection wouldn't find Storm now since it isn't doing anything.
Right.
Right? You know, if the thing sucked down half of your memory, that would be something evident to look at.
But it doesn't do that.
No, no.
It's not really doing much of anything.
No.
So this concept of adaptive malware, right? Software that really and truly can morph and change itself, over time in order to stay undetected. I mean, it really is a pretty scary thing.
It is, but believe it or not, we can actually build environments that limit the spread of something like that right now. And this kind of hits home with some of the points I've been making here this year. Business agility in the 21st century, if I could use a marketing phrase, is often hampered by highly locked down configurations. And an argument could successfully be made that users can be more productive when they can identify and install the software that they need to do their own jobs. But that means that malware will come along for the ride. And so maybe, even though it's interesting to talk about, it could be that if the malware is going to get more and more sophisticated, we need to continue figuring out how to keep desktops constrained. More effective mechanisms to define what is allowed and then therefore assume everything else is evil. You know, I'm thinking like software restriction policy, but
sure.
Improved.
But a better version of that.
Yeah.
I mean, certainly there's been a lot of talk here this week at the IT forum here in Barcelona about the balance of usability, right, with the structural type stuff like security and IT. And it sounds like that's really kind of what you're hitting on.
It is. And I would like to give an example about how to achieve that balance.
Sure.
A while back, I spent some time chatting with a customer in Australia who was combining 40 separate companies into a single company. And they pretty much had given up any idea of trying to consolidate their computers, understand, get an inventory, know what the software is running. And they said, we're just going to have to let everybody run everything. And we're really afraid of what that environment is going to look like. And I said, no, you don't. You can make an announcement and you can say on February 15th, whatever, March 15th, we will push a standard configuration down to every machine we can identify on the network. And that standard configuration will include the following items, blah, 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 you know, office, whatever.
Right.
and then simply sit back and wait for the phone to ring. And every time the phone rings, don't look at it with trepidation or, oh, there's some other user complaining about something they can't do.
Right. You take it as an opportunity.
Right. Yeah. And don't think of it as an IT project either.
Sure.
Think of it as a business change project. You're going to get 300 people who call and say they need AOL Instant Messenger. No, they don't need AOL Instant Messenger. They need enterprise-grade instant messaging services, and you're going to give them one that's designed to work within the corporation, and then you'll add that to the list of the allowed programs. This is what turns an IT department from a blocking mechanism into a business-enabling mechanism. And I think it solves the problem, and it finds that middle ground.
Yeah, they used to call it security by scream. It says, turn it up and see who yells. As long as your reaction to the yell is, yep, I can fix that.
Sometimes that's an entirely appropriate choice.
Sure. I used to drop reports just to make sure people were using them because they'd call if they couldn't find it.
Yeah.
And sometimes it might be 3 months or 6 months before they noticed it was gone.
Right.
But eventually they noticed and validated that it was needed.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that kind of the old trick of if you're writing a term paper for school, you slip in something completely unrelated and meaningless to see if the professor is reading?
So that one third of your paragraphs are, you know, just gibberish.
Latin or something.
Yeah, Latin. Nothing actually meaningful or relevant.
Right.
Sure.
Right, right.
You know, some of the work that I've been involved in the past has really been focused on let's get users involved. Create some ownership, if you will, in that security process. What's been your experience in that? I think that maybe you can reflect off of my experience is, which is that when you do truly involve users and provide them, in order to do that, you have to provide them a level of education and training and knowledge and a little bit of ability to get things done. But that if you do that, if you're really clear that if it's done well, you can have real success in terms of really elevating the security operational security level of the business or of the organization that you're working with.
Let me maybe put this in a slightly different example. We have all shopped at stores where the people you're dealing with have no power to do anything to solve a problem if you have one. And these are stores we hate having to go to. We've also experienced shopping at stores, and Nordstrom is one example, where the frontline people, the people running the cash registers, the people walking the floors, have been given power to do whatever they need to do to keep the customer happy. You know what's interesting? These are the stores that have the least amount of loss.
Yeah.
Attributable to employees. Because these are employees who have been given a certain amount of trust, who have taken on, because of that trust, an ownership of their reputation and of the customer's desire to return.
That's really the difference between assignment and empowerment.
Exactly.
Right?
Now, can we apply this very successful thinking to the point you made? If we can somehow make it so that the people who work at some corporation feel like they own the data and are responsible for the data and its movement, I think we can go very far toward reducing the number of data breaches that we see.
Yeah, my experience has been, if I'm the employee, if I'm the user, right? I don't like the term user, you know.
Only two industries in the world where we call our customers users.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm still trying to think of the other one. Okay.
Okay.
Hence, yeah, exactly. So but for lack of a better term for right now,
yes.
You know, if we have people that we work with that are, mm-hmm. that are empowered and given some responsibility, but if I'm working somewhere, what really matters to me is what do I get out of it, right? Mm-hmm. What's the benefit to me as an individual? I mean, ultimately everybody in some way, shape or form is, if not self-centered, then at least a little bit selfish, right? So,
yes.
You know, I could do an awful lot of work and put in hours and hours of effort and really to get distracted from my core job in order to help Steve, right?
Mm-hmm.
But what is it that I'm getting out of it? Because I may do work or do something that would really help Steve benefit, you know, build the security if there's maybe even just a little shred of something that I get out of it that's tangible to me.
And that's the hard part, right?
How sure.
do you, and different personalities have different things that would motivate them to do that, right? You know, what motivates me to do my job is watching people learn. I love helping people solve problems. I'm not really a money-motivated kind of guy. But other people are motivated by much more personal things than that, right? I think you know, for thousands of years, we figured out how to pay people and motivate them to do work. There is some thinking, I'm sure, that could be done, and I haven't really given a lot of thought myself, so I may not have an answer for you, around using those same techniques to motivate people to care about, keeping data private and secure, too.
You know, what's fascinating is the bad guys have figured this out.
Yeah.
They work on this every day. What will motivate you to give away information you shouldn't give away?
Chocolate bars for passwords.
Yeah. Yes. Other classic ones like dropping USB keys in the parking lot because people will pick them up and stick them in their machines, plug into the curious mechanism.
Yeah.
How do we turn that into a constructive reflex?
Well, in many cases, security is all about telling people what they're not allowed to do. And humans of all kinds hate being told what you cannot do.
If you tell me no, I will rebel.
To do it.
Yes,
that's right.
Absolutely.
So I think fundamentally, to get people to care, we need to start talking about what you can do. Here are the things you can do. This data is used for these circumstances, and this data is used for these circumstances. And here again, this is something where I've just begun researching thinking, so I don't have a lot of answers yet, but we have to get better at this, because your point, Richard, was exactly right. The bad guys have moved away from attacking technology, and they are attacking people. I talked about social engineering at these conferences 3 years ago, and it's only become a bigger problem.
Yeah, they keep getting better at it bit by bit. And you're right. I'm just going through my head various group policies, and every one of them is about a restriction.
Mm-hmm.
It's never about an access.
That's right. And even when Windows version 10 implant edition comes out in about 3 years, group policy for people will only, again, be restrictions.
It'll be restrictions. Yeah. We fundamentally manifest security as negatives.
That's right.
Fundamentally.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the difficulties that all IT and in turn security or technology focused management really has to, in order to be a proactive management style, right? Instead of always reacting and being in firefighting mode, you have to think about how do I enable instead of how do I restrict. So,
right.
So, I mean, this again is just a common theme ringing through in the security area here.
There's maybe an area where we can begin to do this. It won't directly change the way we think about security from negatives to positives, but at least it could help us start moving down that line. One other area that I've been reading a lot about lately and have talked about some too is the link between economics and security. And I have an example that I discovered that I love to use in presentations. You decide you want to deploy enterprise-wide anti-spyware. You go to your chief financial officer. You say, hey, I want to do this. And I want to do it because it'll keep our computers safe and they won't get spyware and they'll get less. The chief financial officer is going to ask you how much it'll cost. You give her a number and then she'll say no. You see, the CFO's job is kind of the same. She's there to restrict the expenditure of the company's money.
Right.
Now, what if instead you did a little bit of work? In the United States, someone who's got a four-year degree in what we would call a knowledge working field and has been out of school for about 10 years makes $72,000 a year. We work 260 days a year. That's assuming the standard 8 paid holidays plus 10 vacation days. A machine that's infected takes 2 hours to fix, and now you've got two people involved, the technician and the person who can't do any work for those 2 hours. That's a $138 cost. Nah, you're not going to win anything with that. A decent, medium-sized org, 1,000 people. Let's make another reasonable assumption that 5% of the machines in that company get infected with spyware every month. Here's how you get your enterprise-wide anti-spyware. You walk into the CFO's office, and you say, hey, I've been thinking about this, what's going on with the expense of maintaining PCs and things like that, and I've got an idea. I have a plan that can help us save $83,000 a year. Can we sit down and have a chat? Because 138 times 5% of 1,000 is $83,000 a year, right? So
I think you've got your CFO's attention now.
Yes.
Purely by rephrasing.
That's right. You've translated the security problem into an economic problem.
Exactly. And ultimately, if we're doing security, we're not doing security as much as we sometimes might approach it that way for the sake of security, we're doing it to enable a business.
That's right.
And a business is a multifaceted, very complicated, lots of different priorities kind of organization.
Mm-hmm.
And the financial aspect of running a profitable business is really key.
It is. And I have then, because of this reading about the financial link between economics and security, I've come up with a new definition of security professional. Our job is not to restrict. Our job is not to stand in front of there and say, or in front of a meeting and say, no, you can't do that whenever someone asks to open a port in a firewall. Our job as security professionals is to figure out ways to help the company save money, or better, make money. We can do that by figuring out how to insert ourselves into the business processes to help improve the integrity of the data, to help ensure that customers and partners can get access to what they need when they need it. There's lots of opportunities here for us to become enablers around reducing costs, around increasing profits. Maybe that's the first step we take, and then we can figure out how to do this user motivation thing that is a lot more difficult.
But you know, it's funny, now that I think about it, the PayPal thing, the strong certificates, that's exactly what that is. It's that positive reinforcement.
Mm-hmm.
I see the PayPal text down below first. And when I see that, then I look up and see the green bar.
Yeah.
And it's only if it was missing that I would go, what's wrong with this picture?
That's right.
It didn't say no. It didn't deny me. It just let me know that things are good. It never really lets me know things are bad. I have to figure that out for myself.
Well, if you get a known bad site,
it's going to be red.
The bar red.
Yeah.
But usually
it's going to be white.
Yeah. How long are those known bad ones going to stick around?
Exactly. You know, and the other thing is, I think that if you think about your security posture, your ability, my background is in online banking, right? Mm. And doing security for running a third of the online banking transactions in the United States. That's a pretty big responsibility.
It is.
And you want to talk about risk. You know, we have to get it right every time, as the classic cliche, the bad guys only have to get it right once, mm-hmm. right, to benefit from it. And so, you know, it's a pretty heavy duty set of responsibility. But if you do it well, you know, and if you really do put it in place, and if it really is meaningful, it can become a business enabler.
Yes.
In a space where security is key, then doing it really well can advance your business in ways that you cannot do it without really doing a strong security focus.
An example that I like to cite is privacy. Privacy is a pain. It's a pain for companies to have to deal with, because now you have to encrypt stuff you didn't have to encrypt before. You have to do some curious things about where people are accessing data from. You have all kinds of different privacy laws. For example, I don't remember whether it was Sweden or Switzerland, have a requirement that if you're going to access data that is that identifies customers, then you cannot do that outside of that country. Well, how do you define Sweden on the internet, right? Right. This is a real challenge.
It is.
But there are known instances of where privacy can be a business enabler.
Right.
If you take the time to ensure privacy of customer identifiable data, and then you make a lot of noise about it, people will come to you because you're demonstrating that you care, and they will be willing to pay more for your product or your service. Now, not everybody, right? But there are some people who would be willing to do that. So, you know, there are plenty of opportunities, I think, where we can look for these ways to help the company make money. I think that's more important than looking for ways to save money, because that always sounds like there's something to do with regulations, and always claiming that we have to be secure because of the regulatory requirement is going to start sounding like the boy who cried wolf someday.
Well, the interesting thing about saving money is you can only save as much as you were spending.
Right.
Making money, there's really no limit.
That's exactly true.
You know, one of the things about taking the focus on the regulatory requirement is there's not a regulation out there that if you follow the letter of the regulatory requirement, ensures that you're running a secure operation.
Yeah, PCI is the one I know you're thinking of.
Yeah, well, that I can think of a few others as well, but PCI does come to mind. But, you know, and so if I'm focused on satisfying regulatory requirements, then I feel like I'm in the mode of dotting I's, crossing T's, and checking boxes, as opposed to covering the grounds, seeing the full picture, and really addressing it from a strategic security perspective.
That is based on your analysis of your risk.
Right, in the context of my business.
Right. The regulatory requirements, unfortunately, are never based on risk assessment.
Or even if they are, they're based on a generic view of risk assessment.
Mm-hmm.
And any risk assessment, if you're really truly doing strong, proactive risk assessment, is always done in the context of the individual business.
Yeah.
You know, because I mean, a banking business is dealing with, you know, I'm a publicly held banking business, then it's going to deal with Sarbanes-Oxley, but also
right.
Gramm-Leach-Bliley and PCI and a bunch of others. But, you know, somebody who's shipping auto parts, you know, isn't going to be dealing with that. And somebody who's in healthcare is going to be dealing with HIPAA, but not, you know, GLB. So it's a whole different world, even just going across the street. It's not always the country you're in. It's quite mm-hmm. often what business do you operate in? Who are your customers?
I had a really interesting reminder of that at a conference a few months ago. I was giving a very simple method of beginning to do risk assessment by plotting risks, perceived risks or actual risks over asset value, and how this helps you determine whether a risk matters or not. And kind of a humorous example that I would give is, in your office, you have a little supply cabinet somewhere that stores paperclips. Now, you don't have a guy whose job it is to full-time stand there and guard those paperclips, because the risk, maybe paperclips actually get stolen a lot, so the risk of paperclip theft is pretty high, but the cost of that risk...
Your exposure is pretty small.
Yeah, exposure is very, very small, right? So yeah, screw it. It's going to cost you more to hire the guy.
Well, especially if you think about how many different places you store paperclips.
That's right.
How many guys do you have to hire? Right?
Now, I've told this story many times, and at this conference a few months ago, there was a guy in the second row who raised his hand and said, well, but we have a paperclip guard. Now, I was like, what?
Really?
You know, I love audiences because they always give me something new. And he said, yeah, I work for a paperclip manufacturing company. So you see, their risk was entirely different. And canned spreadsheets that do these computations for you and regulations, you know, like you said, they don't address individual business models.
Right. And they often don't address individuals.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Two critical things to keep in mind. I think we're just about out of time.
You're right. We're just about out of time. Steve, any last thoughts?
I think we've covered probably some of the most important things that are on my mind right now. So the only thing I'd like to say left to say is be safe, be secure, and use all this for good, never for evil.
Very nice. We've been talking to Steve Riley, and we'll talk to you next week on Run As Radio.